So it's a pleasure for me to be here at this nice, interesting conference, and I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to come here, also to present some general ideas. Now I want to discuss the approach to quantum gravity from the field theoretical side, and I emphasize in particular the question of general covariance and of background dependence. Now I will, my talk consists of the following points. So after introduction I will discuss the concept which we termed locally covariant quantum field theory. Actually this concept was already presented in the loop conference in Potsdam, I think, by Rainer Ferch, so this is more review. Then I will mention some new developments, namely some better conceptual understanding of the role of locality in this framework, which turns out to be related to a tensor structure of the whole business. And I will then discuss the time slice axiom, which has to do with the boundaries, space-like boundaries of space-time, and the existence of a dynamical law. And finally, I will come to perturbative quantum gravity. Unfortunately, this point will not be as precise as the first four points. So the main problem of quantum gravity is, in my opinion, that in quantum physics, space and time play an a priori role. So all concepts are related to a given notion of space and time. You see it on a superficial point of view that you speak of fields which depend on space-time points, but you can analyze quantum field theory in more detail, and always you will find this reduction to notions of space and time. And this is, of course, not acceptable for a theory where space and time itself is dynamical. Now, this fact motivates rather radical new approaches, well known as string theory and loop quantum gravity, but there are also other ones. And I think it's fair to say that typically these approaches have problems if they should be related to present day physics. Now, here I want to discuss a much more conservative approach, which starts from what we already know. Namely, we know quantum field theory very well. It's tested in many instances. So let's see how far can we go starting from quantum field theory. So the first step is that we assume that space-time is already given. It's just a Lorentzian manifold. And the quantum fields live on this manifold. Then we know that gravitational forces are very weak, so we expect that this theory has a huge domain of validity. Actually, it's probably very difficult to find any effect which is not described by this theory. And in the second step, then, gravitation is quantized around a given background. Now, it's well known that this approach meets in the second step very huge difficulties. First of all, the theory is non-renormalizable. Nowadays, non-renormalizability may be not as bad as one has thought it maybe 20 years ago. There's the concept of effective field theory, which we already heard about. But the other problem is that the background metric influences the structure of the theory in a very non-trivial way. And so it's not clear whether you can find a consistent theory which is background independent. Now, what about the first step? Now, the first step looks at the first moment very harmless because quantum field theory is based on on properties of causality. Now, causality makes sense on quite general Lorentzian spacetime, so it seems that you can do a lot, but it turns out if you have a closer look into quantum field theory that the symmetries of Minkowski space play an important role in the actually actual construction of quantum field theories, and its generalization to non-trivial spacetimes creates problems, even in the most symmetric cases, but we are of course interested in the generic case. So what are the problems in the generic case of a globally hyperbolic Lorentz manifold? Now actually, the problem is that almost none of the concepts which you usually use in quantum field theory, as it's, you can find it in textbooks, is valid on a generic Lorentzian manifold. So to start with, there is no concept of a vacuum. The vacuum, the Minkowski space, is an invariant state, which is ground state of energy. These are all concepts which are not valid on a generic manifold. The next problem is that the concept of a particle is not well defined. And correspondingly, there is no well-defined concept of an S-matrix. You cannot define a unique, distinguished Feynman propagator just because the Feynman propagator is the vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product. But because there is no distinguished vacuum, there is no Feynman propagator. Because of the absence of translation invariance, there is no momentum space. And in quantum field theory, we are used to use a Euclidean formulation because it's much more convenient in calculations. But it's just not true that a generic Lorentzian manifold has an analytic extension for which another real section is a Euclidean manifold. It's just not true. And furthermore, there is no path integral, which is the Fermat-Fissman covariant. This, if you look at the formal expressions, the expression for the path integral looks covariant, but if you try to define it, you see that it's not true. It's just not possible to define a Fermat-Fissman covariant path integral. Okay, now these are problems, but these problems have been solved. And they have been solved by using methods from algebraic quantum field theory and by the mathematical theory of microlocal analysis, which replaces the momentum space calculations. And the method is that one defines the analog of the Haag-Kastler axioms, now generalized to generic Lorentzian spacetimes. And the problem one had to solve is that the causal structure, as I already mentioned, is well-defined, but there are, in the generic case, no non-trivial symmetries. And this is actually a very severe question, namely, in quantum theory, we are supposed to repeat experiments in order to get probability statements, to check probability statements. And if you don't have a symmetry, it's not clear what it means to repeat the same experiment. Now, one candidate for symmetries would be the diffeomorphism group, which have already been discussed in the previous talk. But diffeomorphisms cannot be full symmetries of the theory because they change the causal structure in general. And then the causal structure is related to the, for instance, to the commutation relations. And this cannot be a symmetry of the theory. So it cannot induce homomorphisms of the algebra of observables. And it's a conflict with the concept of locality and the concept of primitive causality. There's a related problem, namely in quantum field theory, a very important role is played by the spectrum condition, just the condition that the energy is bounded below in a Lorentz invariant way. On a curved spacetime, it's not clear what has to be put on this, on the place of the spectrum condition. And you need some condition, but with a condition which is generally covariant. Now, these problems have been solved, and I mentioned some of the previous work to the solution. One is the work of Dimmock, who first formulated the Haag-Kastler axioms for globally hyperbolic spacetimes. And he replaced the Poincaré covariance in the Haag-Kastler framework by the requirement, natural, that we you have covariance under all isometric diffeomorphisms. But of course, this has a disadvantage that in the generic case, this is just the identity. Now then the problem of the vacuum state was addressed particularly by K, who replaced this condition by the condition not on a single state, but on a class of state. And the so-called Hadamard condition was postulated to be the correct characterization for admissible states, and Ferch showed that on the level of representations of some local system, the corresponding representation is independent of the choice of the vacuums of the Hadamard state. So the you don't have a unique vacuum, but locally you still have a unique representation, which makes possible a lot of calculations which usually are done in Fock space. And related to this is also the work of Haag, Naunhofer, and Stein, who postulated what they call the principle of local definiteness, which fixes the theory in the small. Another work which one should mention here is the work of Wald and collaborators on the renormalization of the energy momentum tensor. And the leading idea was here that one has to regularize the energy momentum tensor by subtracting counter terms, but the allowed counter terms should be local functionals of the metric. And he showed that this is possible in Hadamard states. And similar is the discussion of K on the Kasinger effect, which uses the same principle that you can locally regularize the energy density. Okay, so this is in a sense a prehistory. Now the modern time starts with a paper by Marek Radzikowski. And this paper contains a very crucial observation, namely what he, for the first time, observed is that the Hadamard condition can be easily characterized by methods of microlocal analysis. And actually, if you formulate this, you see that this is really the local, more precisely, the microlocal version of the spectrum condition. So there's a precise mathematical meaning of a spectrum condition at a point. And then all this machinery, which was developed by mathematicians, starting from with Hermander and Düstermat in the 70s, which had developed in the last decades, could be used. This was then the basis for work by Brunetti, Köhler, and myself, where we proved that in quantum field theory on curved space and free quantum field theory, one can define all the usual normal products and show that there's operator value distributions. And what does it mean physically? Physically, it means the following, that these fields have not only well-defined expectation values, this was the work of Wald, but also their fluctuations are finite. So if you want to apply this, for instance, for the energy momentum tensor, and you want to say the energy momentum tensor of the quantum field is a source for the gravitational field, it's important that this source has not too high quantum fluctuations. And this is guaranteed by this work that these fluctuations are at least finite. Finite means you smear the energy momentum tensor over some small region, and then you get a quantity which has finite fluctuations. And with the same method, but with much more effort, we then were also able to do the renormalization to all orders in perturbation theory. This was work with Brunetti. But there was one problem which we did not solve, which is connected with the symmetry problem I already mentioned. Namely, in renormalization theory, you have free renormalization constants. And in the absence of symmetries, these constants turn out to be functions of space-time. And it was just not clear what it means that you do the same, you put the same renormalization condition at different points of space-time. Okay, now this now was solved by postulating a new framework which was termed locally covariant quantum field theory. And this was introduced in a series of papers by Ferch, Hollands and Wald, and by Brunetti, Ferch, and myself. Particularly Hollands and Wald solved this problem of fixing the renormalization constant, so comparing the renormalization constant at different points, so that you really have a finite number of parameters, three parameters in a quantum field theory on curved space-time. Now, what is the idea in this concept? The idea is that you should no longer try to construct quantum field theory on a specific given space-time, but you should do it on all space-times at the same time, in a coherent way. So it means the following. So we start from some space-time, which is assumed to be a Lorentzian manifold, globally hyperbolic, oriented and time-oriented, and global hyperbolicity just means that M is the manifold is diffeomorphic to the time axis times some Cauchy surface, sigma. And the crucial question is now, how can these space times compare with each other? You could say, well, I just use diffeomorphisms, but this would be too weak, because this would just replace, as Thomas mentioned before, replace coordinates by geometry. So all manifolds which are diffeomorphic are considered to be the same, but you would not be able to compare different manifolds with each other. But this can be done by a slight generalization. You replace you replace diffeomorphisms by embeddings. So you compare spacetimes the following way. So you look at an embedding of a spacetime N and a spacetime M and call it admissible if it's isometric. So the metric is the same and the orientations are preserved. And in addition, it should be causally convex. Now, what is causally convex? Means the following. If you have a causal curve in the spacetime M, where the endpoints belong to the image of the spacetime N under this embedding chi, then the whole curve should be the image of a causal curve in the original spacetime. So it just means that there are no, this embedding does not produce additional causal relations. And these are called admissible. And the concept is that a spacetime, a subregion of a given spacetime can be considered to be a spacetime in its own right. And everything which is formulated on the larger spacetime should already be valid on the smaller spacetime. So this is a very strong locality requirement. And this can then be formalized in a set of axioms, which I want to write here. So first, we associate to every space-time its algebra of observables, which is assumed to be an algebra with a unit, with a star operation, and in the best of all worlds, we would take a C-star algebra. And applications, one often has to be more modest. Then we have these admissible embeddings of one spacetime into another, and we assume that to every such admissible embedding, there corresponds an admissible and corresponding algebraic embedding. There exists a homomorphism of the algebra A of N into the algebra A of M, and if we iterate such embeddings, so chi is an embedding from N into M, chi prime an embedding from M into L, then the homomorphism corresponding to the composed embedding is just the product of the homomorphism for the single embeddings. So this looks like a covariance relation. And so think for a moment on a spacetime which has a lot of symmetries. Then every symmetry would be at the same time an admissible embedding. And then this relation then this relation here would just be the usual representation of the symmetry group by automorphism of the algebra of observables. But here this is much more general, so we have much more embeddings and than isometric diffeomorphisms. Okay, now this can then also formulate the locality axiom. The locality axiom says the following. If you have two spacetimes N1 and N2, you embed both of them into the same spacetime M, and such that the images are space-like separated in the larger spacetime M. Then the locality requirement says that the commutator should be trivial. So this is the usual commutator property of quantum field theory now in this abstract framework. And the existence of a dynamical law is formulated in the so-called time slice axiom. The time slice axiom says the following in this framework. We have an embedding of a spacetime N into a spacetime M. And we assume that the image of N contains this Cauchy surface of the spacetime M. Then the requirement is that the algebra alpha chi of A of N already contains the full information on A of M. So all by the equations of motion, everything in the algebra A of N can be already expressed in terms of this algebra. Okay, now what is the how can we understand this structure mathematically? Now, what offers itself here is the theory of categories. So the first three axioms just tell us that the quantum field theory A can be considered to be a functor between two categories. One is a category of spacetime, which I called lock here for localization. So this is a category cares for localization. And the Lorentzian spacetimes are the objects of this category, and the morphisms of the category are the admissible embeddings. And the other category is the category of observable algebras. So these are these unital star algebras. And there the morphisms are homomorphisms. And the functor, the action of the functor on a morphism of the category lock is just this homomorphism alpha chi defined before. So this gives a formulation of quantum field theory which takes into account the principle of general covariance. Okay, now let me look at the let me take a closer look to these axioms 4 and 5. So question, can they be also be understood in this abstract categorical framework? And actually this is true for the axiom 4, which is the locality axiom. Namely, the statement is that the locality of the quantum field theory is nothing else as the tensoriality of the functor A. So what is the tensor structure in the localization category? Well, that's very obvious. You take something which you usually would not do because you consider to be uninteresting. You take the disjoint union of spacetimes. This has all properties of a tensor product. This has also unity, which is the empty set. And on the level of observable algebras, the tensor structure is the tensor product of algebras. And now we can look at embeddings of spacetime M in a disjoint union from M with N, and J is from the embedding of N in this disjoint union, and look for the corresponding algebraic homomorphisms, and they are just given by these simple definitions. So alpha I of A is A tensor, the unit of the algebra A of N. Alpha J of B is the unit of A of M tensor B. Okay, so this is just a tensor structure in both cases. Now, what is this good for? Now, this comes about if you look at the properties of admissible embeddings. So we look at an admissible embedding of a disjoint union into another spacetime. So what does it mean that this embedding is admissible? First of all, the restrictions to these components M and N must be admissible. But in addition, we know that there cannot be a causal curve connecting the images of chi of M and chi of N. So these two subregions must be space-like separated. Why? Because if there would be a causal curve, there should would be a pre-image in the disjoint union. But in a disjoint union, there cannot be, can of course be no curve going from one point in one component to a component in the other curve. So you see that this concept of admissibility together with this tensor structure just implies the locality axiom. And I want to formulate this as a theorem. So if A is supposed to be a tensor functor, then the theory automatically is local, in the sense that the locality axiom is satisfied. And vice versa, if you start from a field theory which is defined only on connected space-time and satisfies the locality axiom, then you can extend it to a tensor functor on all space-times. Okay, I don't want to give a proof of this theorem, which is not very, very complicated. Instead, I wanted to discuss the fifth axiom, the time slice axiom, and discuss its relation to cobordisms. So let sigma be a Cauchy surface of our spacetime M. And now we want to associate to sigma a certain algebra. So sigma should take care of the initial conditions, and A of sigma should be the algebra generated by the initial conditions. Now, how can this be done? Now, this can be done in the following somewhat abstract way, namely we define this algebra as the inverse limit of the algebras A of n, where we take for n all admissible submanifolds of M which contain sigma. And more precisely, this means the following. So the elements of A of sigma are families AN. AN is now an element of the algebra A of N. And we require that these families are consistent in the following sense, that if N2 is a subregion of N1, and N1, N2 is the natural embedding, then I require that this embedding applied to A of N2 just gives A N1. And actually, it's not really the full family which is needed. It's only the germ of this family needed, which means that it's sufficient to look at this family for sufficiently small N. So you can restrict everything to a small neighborhood of the Cauchy surface sigma. Okay, now we can define an homomorphism of the algebra A M sigma of the algebra A sigma into the algebra A of M just by this definition. Yeah, we define alpha M sigma on such a family A by alpha M N on the element AN in this sequence. And because of this consistency condition, this is this is well defined. Okay, up to now we did not use the time slice axiom. Now we use the time slice axiom. What does the time slice axiom tell us? The time slice axiom tells us that these homomorphisms are actually isomorphisms. And then we can prove that also alpha M sigma is an isomorphism. And this can now be used to define a propagator from one Cauchy surface to another Cauchy surface. Namely, because it's an isomorphism, it has an inverse, so we define the propagator from one Cauchy surface sigma 2 to another Cauchy surface sigma 1, both lying in the same spacetime M by this combination. We take the inverse of alpha M sigma 1, compose it with alpha M sigma 2. So this realizes something which was postulated by Schwinger long ago. Schwinger wanted to write the Schrödinger equation in a covariant way, so he wanted to replace the evolution in time by the evolution from one Cauchy surface to another Cauchy surface. Now it was shown by Taucher and Varadarajan that such a unitary operator on the Hilbert space does not exist, even in free field theory in Minkowski space, if you admit generic Cauchy surfaces. Only in two dimensions there's an exception. Now Buchholz and Ferch did something similar but somewhat more general. So they instead of looking at unitary operators on the Hilbert space of states, they looked at isomorphisms on the algebra of observables, and they could construct such objects for the free Dirac field. But it was not clear how to generalize this to generic theories, for instance, to interacting theories, because of renormalization problems. You know that the fields at time zero are in renormalized perturbation theory, usually not well defined. So this is not clear. So in this, but you see from this abstract construction, there's always a well-defined notion of a propagation from one Cauchy surface to another Cauchy surface. And we can understand this structure as a kind of cobordism theory. So let M be a Lorentzian space-time with future and past boundary, sigma plus and minus. And so M can be considered to be an arrow from sigma minus to sigma plus. And we have then a similar structure as was postulated by Siegel in the theory of topological field theory, namely we get for each such Cauchy surface sigma, an algebra A of sigma, and the manifold M just provides an isomorphism between these algebras. So this, in Siegel theory, you associate to surfaces Hilbert spaces and to cobordisms between surfaces, you associate endomorphisms of homomorphisms of these Hilbert spaces. So here this is the same structure, but not on the level of the Hilbert spaces, but on the level of the observable algebras. And this exists in large generality. The only assumption was where the axioms are formulated. But one should be a little bit cautious, namely, sigma is a Cauchy surface, so the question is what are the structure of sigma which are relevant for the structure of the algebra A of sigma. And in general, as you can see from the construction, the algebra A of sigma depends not only on the manifold structure of sigma, but also on the way this manifold is embedded into the space-time, the Cauchy surface sigma is embedded into the space-time M. Now let us just look at two examples. So the does not work. Ah, okay, thank you. Two examples. One is the free scalar field. So there you can identify this algebra A of sigma with the algebra of canonical commutation relations. And then the algebra is fixed in terms of the Cauchy data. And the Cauchy data are pairs of a function with compact support on sigma and a D minus 1 form on sigma with compact support. And so you only need the manifold structure. But when you want to enlarge your algebra, namely also to include big products, which you should do for almost all practical applications, you need a larger algebra, which was constructed by Michael Dirch and myself. And then you see that this structure that you need more structure of sigma. In particular, here you need the germ of the metric of M. Maybe not the full germ, probably the jet space is sufficient. So it's, certainly you need more structure. Okay, now I come to the last point of my talk, and namely the question, can we say something new about perturbative quantum gravity? So this, we split the metric into a background metric, into a quantum field. Now, we know that this is quantum field as any other quantum field, so we can do the standard way of doing the renormalization. We have to use this method of renormalization on curved spacetime, which was developed before, and which means in particular that we use the Epstein-Glaser method of renormalization. What is characteristic for the Epstein-Glaser method is that the interaction is switched on only in the compact region of spacetime. So this has no direct physical meaning. It's only convenient because then you can have a smoother transition from the free theory to the interacting theory. It's just technically convenient, and because the whole framework is local, it is no loss of generality. So at the end, you find the full interacting theory. So this can be also done here. And now the question is, what about the background dependence? So the background dependence could be discussed in terms of these propagators, alpha, m, sigma 1, sigma 2. Because we have two different background metrics. For both of them, we can do these constructions. The background metrics only have the property that the full spacetime is globally hyperbolic, no further property. Then we can compute this, and we assume that these background metrics differ only in a compact region between the two Cauchy surfaces. So what background independence means that this propagation should not see what we call the background gauge. So this is just the new renormalization condition. The renormalization condition is that the propagator should be independent of the background metric. Now we can look at an infinitesimal version of this condition. So we just differentiate this isomorphism with respect to the background metric. And if you look at the equation which comes out, it's just Einstein's equation for the interacting gravitational field. So it seems that it's completely consistent and gives the background independent theory. Of course, if one wants to do this, one meets obstructions, as one can imagine. So I already mentioned the non-renormalizability, and that's a point which one has to hope that the correction terms, the counter terms which occur in higher orders are sufficiently small. Then there's a technical point of imposing constraints. Now, the best way to impose the constraints is by the BST method, which is highly developed in perturbation theory. Actually, you need some generalized version of the BST method, which has only been very recently completed by a paper by Stefan Hollands, which appeared, I think, a few days ago. So this, you see that there's some effort which is necessary to do everything, every step. But it seems that BST for Young-Mills in this general framework works. And there is no obstruction visible why not the same thing should work for quantum gravity. But it has not been done yet. Then there is some interesting possible obstruction, which has not been elaborated the moment. Namely, if you have this BIST framework, you at the end, you have to construct the observables as a cohomology of the BIST operator. Of course, this if you have proved BIST invariance and so on, you can do it at the end, but you have to prove that the arising theory is sufficiently rich. Now, here in the first step, you would do in Young-Mills theory, you would do it locally, but here, because local regions are not diffeomorphism covariant, you would expect that the local BIST cohomology is trivial. So you have to use instead of the local BIST cohomology global objects. And what are the candidates for global objects? I think this is again something which was already discussed in the previous talk. That's a difficult question. But there are candidates for global quantities, namely the fields. Now, what are the fields? The fields here are considered to be natural transformations between the functor of test function spaces and the quantum field theory functor. So they are completely defined in this abstract framework, and means the following. So we have phi as a field, d is the functor of test function spaces, a is the functor of quantum field theory, and phi is more concretely, so phi is supposed to be a natural transformation between these two functors, which means the following, that phi is a family, phi m, for all space times m in our localization category, and if we're and for every test function f, phi m of f is an element of the algebra A of m. So roughly speaking, phi m is an operator value distribution. Now the naturalness requirement is the following. If chi is an admissible embedding from the spacetime n into the spacetime m, and I apply the corresponding homomorphism alpha chi to the operator phi n of f, I get exactly the operator phi m is the push forward of the test function f. Again, this is nothing else as the usual covariance property for fields on Minkowski space when you replace embeddings just by Poincaré transformations. Yeah, so it's very natural to define it in this way, but this concept of natural transformation does no longer refer to a specific spacetime. So it's a global concept. So you can talk about the same field on completely different spacetimes. Okay, so I have to close at this moment because not only because of time, but because there is work which has to be done, which has not been done, and so I come to the conclusion. So we have seen that the construction of quantum field theory on generic Lorentzian spacetime is possible. I have only presented the axioms and the ideas, but the construction can be done for any local quantum field theory. And it's completely consistent with the principle of general covariance. It seems, here I'm a little bit more cautious because this is work which has not been carried through in detail. It seems that there is no obstacle to include in this construction also the quantized gravitational field. Interesting enough, there are a lot of other approaches from field theory to quantum gravity, which point also into the direction that it might be possible to get statements on quantum field theory on quantum gravity from quantum field theory. I mentioned the work of Reuter, which we will hear this morning, and Björn Bohr, and there was a talk of John Donak, which I unfortunately missed because I came too late, on the same issue. So it seems that there is a hope that you can do it, and as far as I understand these other approaches, they start from Minkowski space, so they are not really consistent with the principle of general covariance. Here we have a framework which is consistent with the principle of general covariance, and I hope that it's possible to transport these ideas which are developed around Minkowski space, to transport all these ideas to the general covariance space time, to the generally covariant framework. And let me start with some remark at the end. I think one quantum field theory should be considered to be also a serious way to quantum gravity beyond the known approaches like string theory or quantum gravity. And in the best of all worlds, once we have found quantum gravity, we perhaps see that all these different approaches are approaches to the same theory. But this is something for the future. Thank you.
First one is specific statement. If I understood correctly, you say that this switch actor is circumvents the local theorem of the foreign
First of all, it's a somewhat different framework. We have no longer unitary operators in Hilbert space, but we have isomorphisms on, say, C-star algebras or observable algebras.
This
would be the key point for the free field. For the free field, you can just circumvent the Toro-Varadayan no-go theorem by going from the Hilbert spaces to the algebras. This idea was very well known, probably it's even mentioned in this paper, I don't remember. But my own reservation against this was always that this is a special feature of free field theory. Because you can see it, what is the reason for these non-existence, these are some divergences which are C numbers. And these C numbers just do not appear if you look at the commutation relations. Yeah, these unitaries, you make a formal commutation, if you can make an expansion into graphs, you get, this is a free theory, so you get very single graphs which are either lines, or loop, but the loop corresponds to a number. And this number just disappears if you go to the algebra. But this seems to be an artifact of free theories. And here you see how you can do it in general for interacting theories.
Yes. The second question is actually much more general, and if you allow me, just follow me. I've been sort of following. And on one hand, I find it extremely clarifying everything that has to do with the quantum field purposes. On the other hand, I've always thought that it cannot work for quantum gravity because of intuitively, very naive, low level way, because general currents washes away the local particles and confuses points, so you a lot of this machinery. Now, at the end of this talk, somehow you say, well, there is some obstruction, and you sort of mention, well, the local heuristic cohomology might be trivial. Are you sure just touching the key difficulty between this thinking and constructing a general quantum
as long as the gravitational field is not quantized, does not interact with the other fields, there's no problem with general covariance. Yeah. Now, once you have do this, then you get this problem which probably shows up in the triviality of the local cohomology. So you have to look at the global cohomology, which is well-defined. And then you can write down the relations, intrinsic relations. And I think this is very similar to what we learned in the talk of Bianca Dittrich on the relational framework. So you instead of using the parameter space-time which you used at the beginning, you use some intrinsic notion of space-time which is defined in terms of the fields.
So what you're saying is that you think that this framework can be compatible with this?
I think this should be completely compatible.
But in what is then also the implemented practically? get the notion of time, for example, that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a group of feet that will be useful as correlative tests in practicing things to have.
This is to be expected, yeah.
One of the challenges that he was at the beginning of the talk was the imputability of experiments, and so probability in the quantum field. So it wasn't that clear to me. Has that problem been solved?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. The fields which I introduced at the end are, in a sense, the objects with which you can define what it means to repeat in experiments, because you know what it means to have the same field on different spacetimes. It's very difficult to say what the same observable is on a different spacetime if it's non-local, because there are a lot of possible variations. But the fields themselves are in some sense well-defined objects in every space-time. So if you say I measure a certain field, this is a measurement which can in principle be repeated. Of course, might be difficult. But in principle, the fields are the means to say what it means to do the same experiment in different space-times, different points of space-time, but in the same moment also in different space-times.
I think my question is related to Carlo's second question and what you just said. As you pointed out, in conventional quantum field theory, the space-time structure plays two roles, both in the formulation of the theory and its interpretation of
yes.
the measurements, where you place an apparatus, where you turn it on, where you observe it, and so forth.
Uh-huh.
Now, Adam Einstein's whole argument, and uh-huh. that out was a definition of a variable that's somewhat different from the usual one. It is not just the variance on the different motives, but the fact that all the properties of the points of the manifold, including their spatial temporal properties, are dynamical properties. And they have no individuating properties until that dynamical structure is imposed. And when you say you could perform the same experiment in different space times, that suggests that you have an individuality which is independent of the dynamical
structure. I must admit, this answer to with the fields at different space-times refers to the space-time where gravity has not yet been quantized. If gravity has been quantized, and this is something which has not been completely elaborated in this framework, you have to go to this, you have to do this global BRS cohomology, and then your only observables are the fields which remain, not the space-time points any longer. And so you have to define then. Yeah, you have to define your space-time localization in terms of the fields. Classically, you can just think of, say you look at points where the curvature vanishes or something like this, and you in quantum field theory is probably not as easy. So it's not clear that the best concept is then a classical space-time for the interpretation. Maybe you use some non-commutative space-time for the interpretation of experiments. But I think this is speculation because this has not been done here.
There are maybe several questions and discussion, but we started 20 minutes late, so we are running into this late. So I would like to close the session, ask the next two speakers to give the number 6 to the computer, and then already done so. Let us be back here in half an hour, which is to say at 11:40.